I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Doreen M. from San Diego. Welcome,
Doreen. Hi, everybody. I'm Doreen, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy birthday, and congratulations to the token takers, and thank you very much for your 10 minutes, and thank you, Randy, for inviting me to speak. You know, when you get invited to speak, you get to spend a long time remembering, which is good because I'm old and I forget. My sobriety date is October 18th, 1998, and my home group is Radical Acceptance over in the clubhouse at 5107, 7 a.m., and my sponsor, Maggie, just had hip surgery, and she's not here. And I'm nervous. But, you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, or if you're coming back, or if you're wondering what you're doing here, I just want to tell you that the change that I have experienced, not so much on the outside, but on the inside, it's kind of impossible that it happened. When I really think about the whole arc of the story, like, I almost think of my drinking self as her. You know, like, she did that. Because not only did my hair go gray in the last 20 years, like, my heart opened up. And I learned how to behave myself. And I learned... I got choices in so many things that I didn't have choices in before. And I learned how to make them in a way that was good for me and good for other people. And I've had adventures, and I've learned to love and be loved. And most of the time, my head is where I am. And none of that was true when I was drinking. I just want to qualify a little bit because I really want to talk about recovery and, you know, back to the not remembering that well. I had a childhood that looked great on the outside. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom was codependent. And everything looked good. And that's a really lonely way to grow up, is what I want to say about it. You know, when the way things are represented is not the way you're experiencing them. And you can't really talk about what's happening. And it was lonely. And when I was 12, my dad had a stroke. And I was the smart one. And he had been very smart until he had a stroke, and then he had below average intelligence, and he was not a happy person ever again, or for a very long time. And I felt like he took it out on me, particularly because I was the smart one. And so I kind of grew up with this idea in my head that being smart made me unlovable. And I got bullied in school because, you know, smart girls in a small town in Northern California in the 1970s, like, a little freakish. and I remember really clearly, this was around the time I started drinking, making a decision, like, okay, I have a choice in life. I can have a life of the mind, or I can be loved. And I'm like, easy. And I dropped out and I went to college. That's an important part of my story, partly because of coming to terms with my dad. But, you know, we have these things that we believe about ourselves that we decide on when we're really young. And then they become what we think is true. And we act out of them for many years with no more evidence that they're true. And that was true for me and my certainty that I was uniquely unlovable, which I drank over and I suffered over for a very long time. And so what happened was I got into Berkeley, and then I got out of Berkeley, and then I kind of, my life crashed, because all I ever did was to get into a good school and get out of a good school. And then I started drinking because I didn't know what else to do, you know? And then I started drinking, and then I was drinking. And after that, I became a daily drinker very quickly after that. You know, when I was in college, I just drank on breaks, and then I became a daily drinker. And I tried to start a life in a few ways, and they didn't really get going, so I went back to school. And I must say I earned a PhD drinking, so don't be too impressed when people are called doctor. Drinking, you know, like, grad school is a great place for a drinker. Because you just have to kind of sober up at the end of the semester. And what I love the most in all the world, is being right. When I came into Alcoholics, see, people who know me laugh because they know it's true. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and people said, would you rather be right or be happy? I'm like, right? Like, anyway, aren't they the same thing? And when I was in grad school, after the seminar, I would go to the bar, and round about the third drink, I was the smartest person in the room, maybe the world. And that was the feeling that I liked, you know? That fed my disease for a long time. Like, that's what I wanted. I wanted that feeling. You know, there was a feeling somewhere between the second and the fifth drink when it was great, you know? And who gave a shit if I was uniquely unlovable? I was smarter than every fucker in that bar. And it might be cold comfort, but it's comfort. And I moved cross-country four times. Did a lot of geographics toward the end of my drinking, and I landed in San Diego, and I got a job. And my drinking started to be a problem, you know, and I had to, and I learned that I could not start drinking around people that I worked with. That I needed to not start drinking until I was not around people that I worked with. And so I collected some lower companions, and there were a lot of emergency personnel involved in our lives. And because of things involving emergency personnel, but they're not as good as your story, so we'll just leave that aside. I decided I was going to quit drinking on my own. I was near losing my job. I mean, it was just like the regular boring wreckage of an alcoholic. And I had a double life going on, and I decided I was going to try and quit drinking on my own. And that's really when my story begins, because that was my New Year's resolution, and my sobriety date, if you'll recall, is in October. And so I spent 10 months and 18 days not quitting drinking and trying every day. And it was the most painful part of my life because I couldn't do it, you know? And what I came to realize is that I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a sobriety problem. Like, I couldn't sleep. I'd been a blackout drinker for a very long time. And I would lie in bed and I was like a broken radio with two channels. I could hate you or I could hate myself. I think of it as my altar of suffering. I would lie in bed and I would think about and replay everything that people had done wrong to me or everything I had done wrong. And, morning would come and I would be without sleep and I would try and do a day. And eventually, 2-3 days of that, I just needed to have a drink. You know, like, I just needed to have a drink. I didn't have any, by then I didn't have my family in my life, and if I wasn't hanging out with my lower companions, I actually didn't have anybody in my life. And I didn't have alcohol anymore, and I never got to feel that feeling, and I couldn't sleep, and I hated you, and mostly I hated myself. You know, I didn't have a God, I was about to lose my job, it was bewildering being sober without any kind of recovery. It was excruciating. It was, and so I would drink, you know, and then I would be a failure. And then I would swear the next day, like, this time I'm really not going to drink. And then it would start again, you know, and I'd get 2, 3, 4 days, and then I would drink. And so then this cat came to my house, and I am like a single cat lady. Like, that doesn't change throughout the whole story. I prefer books to people. Like, that doesn't change throughout the whole story. It's just inside and the gray hair. But so this cat, this pregnant cat, shows up at my house, and then she has kittens, and one of them lives, and this all happens at this time. And I've got this little kitten. I named it Ranger, the Lone Ranger, the only surviving kitten. And I, like, really like cats better than people. And it was a beautiful October afternoon, and I lived in the second story apartment in Hillcrest. And, you know, I had the door open so the cats could go in and out because I was going to keep an eye on them. And then I went to the liquor store, and then it's 9 o'clock, and I'm passed out. And, is that your cat? Well, it's dead. And it was just like, oh, my God. Like my kitten had wandered in the road and been hit by a car. And I'm like borrowing a shovel from a neighbor and burying the cat in the little area in the apartment complex and crying. And, you know, I knew it was my fault. I knew that whatever else, okay, my family didn't talk to me and I didn't have any friends, but I also killed my kitten, which just seemed to me like, it just broke my heart. It broke my heart that I couldn't even keep a promise to, like, this, you know, the sweetest little cat, the thing I loved the most. I couldn't, like, keep from drinking and passing out. And I had a friend where I worked who had gotten sober a couple years before after a night of drinking with me, which is another issue. And I went into his office to ask him something entirely different, and I asked him to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the first time something came out of my mouth that I hadn't thought of first. Like, I wasn't thinking about it. I hadn't planned on it. I just was, I was at the end of my rope. And I got to tell you, a week before all of this happened, I read a book that it was comparing prayer and poetry, and for my academic mind, it opened a little window where it was possible for me to pray through my, like, insomnia and, you know, noise in my head and suicidal thoughts. And I had one night when I was able to pray for the first time since I was a Catholic girl, and I realized the nuns had to marry Jesus and I couldn't be a nun. And I asked God for the ability to forgive myself and others. That was my prayer. It was the first prayer I'd probably prayed in 20 years. Because I just lay in bed every night hating myself and others. And I prayed that prayer, and within a week, I was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in, and I was so freaked out that it all happened, that something had come out of my mouth I hadn't intended to say, that my poor cat was dead, and I really did not want to fail at Alcoholics Anonymous. I also just didn't want you people to be better than me. And I got a sponsor, you know, who also worked with me, and she saved my life because I knew she was really smart, and I knew she wasn't going to join a cult, and I knew she wasn't going to be, you know, in any place that was sexist or stupid. I mean, because I already respected her. And that really helped me to know that there could be a place for me, even though I didn't really believe any of that was true. But I was out of ideas. You know, I had a problem. That one thing I knew when I came in is that I could not stop drinking. I could not. I had applied my will to the very best of my ability over and over and over again. And it was getting worse every time I drank. And I knew that I could not control my drinking. And, you know, my father, after he had that stroke, he sat on that couch and he drank at us for many years. You know, and I have suffered being in the home of a angry, bitter alcoholic. And I never wanted to be like that, and I was exactly like that. I was a mean drunk, you know? I was not a box of chocolates. I have a very good facility with the English language. And put a few drinks in me, I will use it to take you out at the knees. That was my, like, superpower. I thought it was funny. And that I was helping you. And that I was honest, because I would tell you what I really thought of you. Not like those fake friends of yours. So I didn't have anybody in my life when I got sober. Needless to say, and I, But I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up at Drunks Only, and the only thing I remember from the first meeting was my friend Pearl, who's now my friend, took a token, and every year when she takes a token, I think, yeah, my first meeting, you were taking a token. And then I heard a guy pass, and I'm like, oh, thank God you can pass. But I kept coming back, you know? I kept coming back because I had a problem and you people had the solution. And I did not like the God talk at all. I don't know. I stayed. I don't know what else to say about it. I kept coming back. And after about 90 days, I figured I was kind of cured, you know? I sort of, the bruises had faded and I was feeling good. And I read the book and I had figured it out. And I have a PhD, in case you missed that. I sort of started to wander off. An ex-boyfriend called, and I moved him in. He was still drinking. That was good. Then it just got crazy, and I was literally driving to Ocean Beach to have a drink. I don't know. I think there's no AA and OB. I don't know what I was thinking. And I heard a voice in my head that said, I heard somebody say it in a meeting one time, like, you're welcome to go out. You can go have a drink. Just go to a meeting first. And I'm like, I'll show you. And I went to this meeting in PB that I'd never been before or since. And I don't know what I heard there that night, but I turned around and I went home. And, you know, we stay sober by seconds and inches. Like, there's so many times in recovery, especially early recovery, when it's just seconds and inches. When, like, if that thought hadn't come to me and if I didn't happen to have a meeting schedule in my glove compartment, because that was before we had cell phones, I would have been drinking, you know. And later that year, I got a cold and I took nighttime cold medicine as prescribed, and it ran out at 3 in the morning. And I know it was 3 in the morning because the liquor store was closed and my drug dealer wasn't answering. And the creature was awake, like full on. I did not give a shit, you know. Like, I was tearing apart my apartment for anything. Like, there is something left in this apartment, you know. Like, there's something somewhere. There's a Xanax. There's a roach. There's something in my apartment. And I'm in the bathroom. You know, because sometimes if you're going across the border, if you hide, like, a joint in your tampons, no one looks there. And I'm, like, shaking them out. Right? True, right? And it's like, I thought, I have this thing. You know, I really have this thing. Like, I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to hear people talk about it, and I thought I was better than you, and I thought I was different from you. And that moment, like, I came to when I really thought, I have this thing. Like, I do not, like, forget that I have a year of sobriety. I didn't care at all. I didn't even think about it at all. Like, that nighttime cold medicine was enough to wake up the creature. And it was on. And I really, like, I had done some steps, but that was really the moment when I made a decision to put both feet in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I really identified. When all the time sitting in the meetings and reading that book sunk in. And I identified. And I thought, I have this thing. And I really got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous after that. And I started doing things I didn't want to do. Like socializing with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I had so much else to do, right? I have so many other invitations. I had been going to, and I really got committed to a women's step study, and it was a step study where the women hung together socially. And I just hung on to those women for dear life. You know, I just hung on to them for dear life. They would have these get-togethers on Sunday nights, and I would go, and I would just, like, be in their kitchen the whole time, doing dishes and cleaning stuff. And that was good enough, you know? Like, actually, I think they really appreciated that. That I just kept showing up, and I started to get more comfortable with them, and I started to trust them. And we had a lot of fun. And I'll tell you what, if you're new and you're not connected to a group that does that, find another meeting. And when people ask you out, you know, if you are able to get willing at all to be able to do that, please go. You know, because really those women and the friendships that I formed with them and the stuff we did, it saved my life. Because I didn't, that was real to me, you know? Like, they were real to me. And they would show up for me, and I could show up for them. People would do things with me that you just had, like, you couldn't tell normal people, like, okay, I've been wearing baggy clothes my whole life. Someone has to go shopping with me for clothes that fit. Like, I have never done that. And, you know, my friends took me shopping. Stuff that seems impossible to us, people in Alcoholics Anonymous will help us do, and they won't laugh at us. You know, they will never laugh at us. And there's so many times that stuff like that happened with these women. The other thing that happened was I just decided that an open mind was sufficient for my spiritual connection. You know, like it says all it takes is an open mind. And I was like, well, I'm open-minded. It's religious people who aren't. And my sponsor's like, good. then you have what you need. And you know what? I had what I needed. I had an open mind. And I was uncomfortable with prayer. And she said to me, ask God in the morning to keep you sober. And at night, thank a God you don't believe in for your sobriety. And I did that. And you know what? I do that still. And over time, what happened was I didn't drink. I have not had a drink or, I took muscle relaxants when my back went out. So that doesn't count because it was prescribed. But that's honestly, other than that nighttime cold medicine, I don't even mess around with prescribed drugs. I have been sober since I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've continued to pray to a God that I don't understand at all to please keep me from drinking. And at night, to thank you for another day. When I got sober, I not only did not have a choice in the matter of drink, I did not have a choice in most things. Really, if you were the least bit, if you acted like maybe you thought I was not the smartest person in the room in some way, I had to take it personally. You know, I had to be hurt by it. I had to be angry. I had so few choices in my emotional responses. Like, I had a story about the world, and that's the only thing I saw in the world, you know, was like, people didn't respect me, I was unlovable, nothing ever went my way, you know, like, I had it so bad. And that was the way I saw the world, and because I saw the world that way, I had so few choices in how I responded to things. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad I've got some time left, this is really what I want to talk about, is how you get from there to your head being quiet most of the time. And that to me, like when I was lying in bed before, you know, trying to quit drinking on my own and hating you and hating me, it was so loud, right? That megaphone of self-hate. Like it was so loud, I almost couldn't function sometimes. Like what was going on in my head if I wasn't drinking was unbearable. And I will tell you today, you know, when I'm in the garden, I'm pretty much only thinking about the pretty little plants. Like, that's pretty much all there is. And that's the great, unbelievable miracle that's happened in my life. Because the truth is, I have the same job. Like, those cats have died, and I have different cats. I mean, like, there hasn't been that much dramatic outward change in my life. But internally, I at some point realized... Well, I want to tell you, go back to the beginning. I went to La Mesa Women's Meeting, and I walked in there, and there were these women. There were these women who were talking about really difficult things in a way I had never heard people talk. You know, they weren't trying to make it okay, and they weren't blaming anybody. They were just being honest about, like, you know, a divorce and a sick mother and, like, a kid who was in trouble. And I had never, ever heard anybody talk the way that they were talking. And that was what kept me coming back, was I knew that there was something here that I had never seen before. Like, this was not bullshit, you know, and it wasn't fake, and you weren't, like, you weren't just trying to look good. You were And you could talk about things in a way I had never heard anybody be able to talk about things. It's so impressive to me. It is still, you know. When I hear somebody applying the principles of the program to hardship in their life, it's really so profound. And it's when I get so grateful that I landed somewhere where I could not just not drink and be an asshole, which is good. I mean, that's good for America. But where I could also grow into being the kind of woman I never even dreamed I could be, you know, where I could really grow up to be somebody that I could trust and respect, because I did not trust myself. And that's one of the hardest things about what our disease does to us, is that we violate our own trust over and over again. I'm not going to do that. Well, I did it. You know, like, we couldn't keep our word to ourselves. And so we're anxious all the time because we've lied to ourselves. I mean, we've lied to everybody, but we have violated our own trust so many times. We get sober and we're like so anxious. Like, yeah, because we're living with somebody that we don't trust, right? And part of recovery is earning our trust back for ourselves. That's been my experience, you know? Like, I learned how to keep my word in Alcoholics Anonymous, including my word to myself. You know, I learned how to keep my word to myself, which I had never done. And I started to be able to relax, because little by little, I would say, I'm not going to do that again. And then I wouldn't do it again. And it was so profound, you know, to just little by little be able to set those different behaviors and then practice them until I started to become somebody different. Like, let me tell you an example I was thinking of when I was trying to remember things. So I used to be a terrible gossip at work. You know, like, you do not want me to know your business, because if I know your business, everybody knows your business. Like, that was the way I was. And I just started, you know, I did the steps and I knew I was that way. And like that painful sixth step, like, I knew it was my way. I knew that people didn't trust me at work because I was a gossip, and I could not stop. I was still doing it. And I would just, like, I would do it and I would be disgusted with myself. And we all have those things where we like see our part and then we keep doing it. You know, and you have to concede, like, I am powerless over this, and I'm going to try one day at a time. Like, I had a calendar where I would count my days of not gossiping at work. You know, it's like, oh, got to start at one again. It was so hard, and I realized by doing that, that it was because I was really uncomfortable at work. In fact, I didn't like my job, and gossiping took the edge off it. And if I wasn't going to gossip, I had to really make some big changes in my job, because, as it turns out, I didn't like it, you know? I ended up actually, because of that, taking a year's leave of absence to try to, like, you know, making a lot of changes in my work life. I had to make, because that's the function that it was serving. And many times I discovered, like, the thing that I kept doing over and over again, when I prayed and I tried and I started changing, I realized that that character defect served me in some way. And I was not going to be able to let it go until I let go of the way it was serving me, the way it was protecting me, the way that I felt like it was whatever. There was something in it for me. And I needed God to be able to live without it. You know, to just go through a day at work and be like, yeah, I don't like this, and not take the edge off by talking shit about somebody. And that became the task once I let go of my bad behavior. And when people say that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we act our way into different thinking, that's my experience of it. That when I'm willing to, like, do everything I can with God's help to stop a bad behavior, then I can get down to knowing what it's about and what I need to let go of and where I need to change and grow in order to be at peace. And I will tell you that I just finished a term as the chair of the grievance committee for my union. So, which means I am, like, the most trusted person in my union, because I know all the grievances. Because people trust me not to gossip at work, right? That is a long journey from where I was to being the chair of the grievance committee for my union. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like, that's the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not, I like... That's why sometimes I have to say she. Like, she was terrible. She, you don't want her to know. But what, you know, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you, like, you could have it all here in terms of being able to continually grow and change. I get bored easily, and I have not been bored in recovery because it's fascinating. In fact, it's just fascinating. You know, I say this a lot, so those of you that, you know, go to the daily meeting with me, forgive me. But being sober is like moving a ton of shit with a teaspoon. You know, like, you get used to the smell, but that spoon is small. But it's not, it's kind of, after a while, really interesting because you get to see what's under there, you know, and decide, like, what am I going to do with it? Now that I'm uncovering it, am I going to keep it? Like, do I like that? What am I even like? I am so different than the way I thought I was. You know, when I did my first fourth step and I got to the fear inventory, I would have told you I wasn't afraid of anything. You know, I had traveled a lot of the world by myself. Like I said, moved cross country four times by myself, left home when I was 17, you know, paid my way through PhD. I'm not afraid of anything, except, as it turns out, absolutely everything, you know? Like, I'm afraid at any moment I'm going to get voted off the island, you know? Like, I still, you know, like, don't open the email. You're going to be fired. It's like, well, I don't even think I can be fired, but that's still there. You know, like, I'm actually a fear-based person. I actually approach situations with fear. I have a very hard time trusting people. I assume that you're like, why are, like, I'm still like, why are you being nice to me? What do you want? You know, like, I'm a fear-based person. I didn't know that about myself at all. Like, I would have told you the opposite. And it's much easier to work with it when you know what's going on, you know? It would have been nice if I had discovered that I didn't have any character defects. That was not what happened when I moved that shit. But I have a pretty good handle on what they are now. And it's given me more humility because I get, like, I'm a human being and I have got some tendencies. And there, you know, so does everybody else. And so does everybody else. And we kind of all do the best that we can. And that's very different from either, like, I'm the best in the world or I'm the worst in the world, which was kind of both theories based on total, like, ignorance of what I was really like. And by doing the steps repeatedly, you know, I've been in a step study, like, my whole sobriety. And I've read the steps and heard the steps read to me over and over and over again and talked about them and written them out. And I've come to have a much more accurate self-appraisal. You know, like, I'm not perfect. I still have buttons that are fully installed and can be pushed. But far fewer, and I know what they are, you know. I'm much humbler about them. You know, I apologize much more quickly for them. They don't do as much damage. I can tell when I'm feeling something. I'll be like, I'm going to step outside of this meeting for just a minute. I know I'm chairing it, but I'm still going to step outside just a minute. And as a result, you know, I have a lot better relations. The eighth step and the ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous are where we really look, where we try to have the best possible relation with all people. That's the point, right? And step eight, we say, what is it like to be in relationship with me? The principle of step eight is brotherly love. Well, I don't have any brothers. It's just love. You know, like, that's the principle of step eight, to try to look at my relationship with other people from their point of view. What is it like to be in relationship with me? What have people experienced? And then step nine is, the principle of step nine is justice, you know, to try to make that right. I had a very difficult relationship with my father. That is a polite way to say it. And I made amends to him. You know, when I first wrote that out, I'm like, what is my part in here? I was a kid. And my sponsor said, well, you know, unrealistic expectations, like you expected him to be somebody he wasn't. You know, you've been mad at him your whole life for being the way he is. Like, that's unrealistic expectations. I'm like, all right, okay. My dad had a heart attack, and I went up and I took care of him, and I made amends to him. And I got so free. It isn't like he said anything that was that meaningful, but I did it. And I was driving down the street one day after I had made those amends, and there was like a country and western song on, a father singing to his daughter, about how she's going to get married, but I loved her first. I'm like, oh, no one's ever going to sing that about me. And then I'm like, so what? A lot of other people love me. And I was like, oh, my God, it's over. It's done. Like, it's just, it was gone, you know, like that committed self-pity, my altar of suffering, my, like, inherent unlovability. Like, I did the steps, and I cleaned it up, and it was the first thought, but it was quickly followed by another fault of, like, oh, but a lot of other people love me. And when he got a terminal diagnosis, I was able to call him every day. I was his last call at night. And my mom said he would wait up for my call because he was in a lot of pain. And I would call him every night. And when he went in the hospital, I drove down, and I was the person who was able to say to him, Dad, it's your last day. You got to, like, whatever you're going to do, this is going to be your last day. You're not leaving the hospital. And that day, we were all in the room, and my sister and I were moving him, and he was in a lot of pain. And it hurt him somehow, and he reached up and he slapped me across the face. And, you know, my dad never laid a hand on me. And I said, she did it! Because my sister was moving him too. But then we all just cracked up, you know, and I said, I bet you wanted to do that for 40 years. And, you know, we laughed, and that was my last interaction with my dad. And I thought, if I had been drinking, I would have gone to my grave suffering over that. But instead, it was sweet. And, you know, I'm sure he had wanted to do that for 40 years, and it was just only because he was on so much morphine, you know. But it like, if you would have told me the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be that I'm going to laugh when my dad slaps me on his deathbed, I'd be like, wow, great club. But when he died, you know, I was able to organize his funeral and do all of that. And because I was clean, you know, I was clean with him. And it is a profound gift to have, like, a life-defining resentment against somebody and be able to clean it up completely so that you can be totally at peace with all of that that went down. And that really was such a powerful, powerful gift in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got 5 minutes. Okay. I want to end up by talking about my higher power, which, you know, I still, here's what I've learned. I don't understand anything about the nature of the divine except that it wants me sober and it would like me to be of service to other alcoholics. And that has proved to be sufficient for me to stay sober for 20 years. You know, the way I understand my relationship with the higher power that I don't understand is it's like being in a rowboat, you know, where I can row facing backwards, you know. And God or my higher power, call it what you will, is steering. And like, if I'm going to go anywhere, if I'm going to move forward, I have to be willing to row backwards. Like, that's the definition of faith to me. Like, I have to be willing to row backwards. I can stop rowing anytime I want and steer, but God won't row. You know, so if like we're going to move, I have to row and not know where I'm going. And I don't like that. I am a big picture person. You know, like, I would like to understand it all and then pick the route, you know, and have that fit. And that has not been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I've been rowing backwards. Just like, do the next right thing. Do the next right thing. Do the next right thing. How is it all going to turn out? I have no idea. But if I start taking over the steering, the boat stops moving. you know, and I can't go anywhere. And that's my understanding of faith. You know, like I just decided to resign from the what is the nature of God conversation because it makes me crazy. It's just me, you know, because it's unknowable and I don't like that. And instead it's like, how do I behave in faith? How do I behave? How would a woman who believed in a loving God behave? We'll do that. You know, like you don't have to actually feel it in your heart. You just have to behave the way a person who believed in a loving God would behave. It's the same, you know. And over time, I have faith in a God that I don't understand, you know. And I have faith that I just need to keep rowing. And that means continue to practice my program, to be of service to newcomers. You know, I've been blessed with a number of people have asked me to sponsor them, and some of them are here tonight, and that's been such an enormous blessing in my life. Because when I'm working the steps with another woman, like, that's when I feel like, okay, my higher power's got me. Like, now I'm doing God's work. Like, I don't know about the rest of it, but I'm definitely doing God's work right here. And I think it's why I like to sponsor so much, because that's when I really feel like I'm in God's hands. That part's clear. And a lot of other things, I just sort of try to do my best. And I think that's the best we get. And you know what? I got to tell you, my life is so sweet. Today, it's kind of boring. but I go to bed at night and I just say, oh, God, can I have one more of the same, please? Like, that was fantastic, you know? Like, the cat fell asleep on my lap and... that was great, and the way the sky looked in the morning, it was beautiful. And I have, I've come to define my life by the parts in it that are good instead of the parts in it that are bad. And that's what I remember, and that's what I notice, and that's what I see in a day. It's the exact opposite of the way it was when I came in. When one bad thing would happen in a day, the month is screwed. And now that's, you know, like the little things that I value and that I can find beauty in are how I come to define my time. And that's a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous and a gift of the practice of gratitude. So, you know, if you're new and if you're uncomfortable, if you're uncomfortable, good for you. Because it means you're doing something different. And if you want to be sober and you want a different life, then you need to do something different. And if you're doing something different, it makes you uncomfortable. And so if you're uncomfortable, it does not mean you're doing it wrong. It means you're doing it right. It sucks. But that's that is the truth. So I think I'm out of time. I really would like to thank you for listening to me. And God bless all of you.